Well, good afternoon. Welcome to the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs. My name is Kathy Coates, and I'm moderating today's session of the council. We want to, first of all, thank our sponsors, the University of Lethbridge, the Herald, of course, Ericsson, where we are here, and Shaw Cable. We want to welcome you whether you're here or whether you're watching us on Shaw Cable. I just have one announcement to make before I introduce the speaker and today's session, and that's to let you know of a fundraiser that SACPA is having, a feast with John Gilchrist, and you'll see various people with these tickets around. It's on March 31st. John Gilchrist, many of you will hear on CBC Radio. He does food commentary and that kind of thing. Really an excellent speaker. So if you want to get tickets, please see one of the executive members or moderators, and others have tickets. So we will today listen to our speaker for half an hour, and then we'll have lunch and a table conversation, and then come back for questions. So I'm very pleased to introduce and to welcome Professor Stephen Kent from the University of Alberta, Department of Sociology. He researches new and alternative religions, and he comes at it from both a sociological angle and a religious studies point of view. Steve has one Bachelor of Arts, two MAs, and a PhD in religious studies, so he's certainly very well qualified to speak to us. He looks at new and alternative religions as a way, as well as some of the controversies that surround them. One of the emails I had from Steve said that he was once quoted in the National Enquirer, and that was the high point. So if you're like me and read it at the checkout counter, now you are legitimized doing that. So today Steve will be giving us some historical background to new and alternative religions in Western Canada. So welcome, Steve, to Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I've heard a great deal about this council and also a fair amount about the restaurant, so I look forward to the afternoon. I'll talk today about a subject that I've been researching for a number of years, and that's alternative religions in Western Canada. There's some remarkable stories that have come out of this part of the country. And I'll talk today about some groups that you no doubt have heard about, and undoubtedly a few groups that you haven't. No extensive account of sectarian groups in this province has appeared for 50 years. W.E. Mann's Church, Sect, and Cult in Alberta from 1955 remains a classic account of the alternative religious environment for the early years of this province, and no one has undertaken an update of it. For years, I and another academic in Edmonton, Gordon Drever, have been collecting materials with the hope of doing so, and I only hope that the two of us live long enough to complete our project. Today I share just a few of these stories with you, but I hope you will permit me to include material from British Columbia and Central Alberta, as well as Southern Alberta, only because a few of these groups from those areas are fairly well documented and also are quite extraordinary. Mann wrote about sects at the time when he and other scholars saw them as growing out of periods of social disorganization, economic exploitation, or lower class persons who had not integrated into society. A more recent perspective, however, on where these groups come from, states that sects occur for any of three reasons, none of which is exclusive of the others. First, sects can be schisms or break off from existing groups. And these schisms can occur over things like doctrines or controversial personalities, group assets, or so on. Second, some groups implode. That is, they collapse into themselves and create their own deviant sectarian subcultures. Finally, sects may arise out of the psychopathology of charismatic individuals, where mentally imbalanced leaders attract followers who see their odd behaviors and teachings as religious signs rather than indications of personality disorders. A couple of characters I talk about today you have to wonder about. From this threefold perspective, sects and unusual religions always will appear, not simply in times of social disorganization, as Mann had emphasized. certainly difficult periods, people may create new faiths in attempts to answer pressing social and personal needs, but other groups will arise in times of relative calm and stability. Now, the six groups that I discussed today may fit these theoretical models, but that is not why I chose them. Rather, I chose them for the drama of their accounts and the relative availability of sources about their actions. Many other sects like this have flourished in this part of the world, but little documentation exists about them. So many of these groups arise, flourish, and then die out, and we hear very little about them. There aren't documents. Documents do not get preserved. They get lost and so on. But just within the documentation that has survived about some of them, we can see that the history of sectarian groups in Western Canada is replete with examples of idealism, chicanery, fanaticism, and far too often broken dreams. Among the more forgotten sects of Western Canada is the Children of Light, whose members for nearly 50 years waited for the end of the world, or at the very least for a message from God about it. The wait began in November 1950 when a schismatic Pentecostal leader, Grace Agnes Carlson of Carrimios, British Columbia, near Oliver and Penticton, believed that she received light through a transaction with God, and through the light of that transaction formed an elite group whose bodies God would use collectively to make a body for our Christ on this earth. This supposed transaction seemingly occurred when God appeared to her as a ball of fire rolling down the mountainside, delivering in an audible voice the message that she was to take away followers into a new non-denominational group. Vancouver newspapers, however, became aware of the group in early 1951 after 35 members, including children, sold their belongings, often at ridiculously low prices, paid their debts, and entered into an extended religious retreat as Carlson waited for a communication from God. With them in Carrimios, in a Carrimios farmhouse, were truant school-aged children, plus a 16-year-old whose mother repeatedly expressed her deep concerns to the press. One apocalyptic prediction already had failed, since Carlson had led her flock to the top of an unusual mountain back in December 1950, and together they passed the night sleeping. Apparently their white robes were to protect them from the atom bombs, which they believed would bring about the world's end. Jesus, however, failed to return, and God failed to give her a message. She, however, and her followers persisted. After a series of confrontations with the surrounding community, the group retreated to Surrey and then simply disappeared. And it was over four decades before the press found it again. The Canadian press only rediscovered the Children of Light when a California newspaper ran a story about it in 1996. Apparently, after slipping out of Surrey, the group wandered around North America for 13 years and traveled an estimated 300,000 miles, finally focusing their energy on Agua Caliente, Arizona. After that location appeared to the leader in letters of fire in the air. The exact dates of events are a bit confused, but either in 1963 or 1967, 18 members purchased land in Agua Caliente, and they began to transform the desert into an oasis. By the mid-1990s, the group operated a self-sufficient commune consisting of a communal hall, a dozen buildings, a solar tower, a vegetable garden to produce two crops a year. Despite its success, the group was dying. Only seven members survived, three from the original BC group, all of whom were in their 70s and 80s. They still believe that the apocalypse was imminent. We believe it's close. We see things getting worse and worse on the outside and better on the inside. Their celibacy, however, doomed them. And one by one, the members face their own mortality. This bittersweet opportunity to observe the decline of a new religion is a scenario that is replayed time and time again. The vast number of new religions blaze brightly and then wither. Their growth, their controversies, and their frequent declines provide the social context which researchers like me gain insight into what is supposed to be humanity's noblest quest, individual and collective salvation. Rather than having to piece together very limited information about the origins, development, and decline of ancient faiths, social scientists of religion get to see religions in the making, the transforming, and with many groups, they're fading. The most destructive and dramatically deviant new religion that operated in the Canadian West during the last century was the Dukhobor schismatic fundamentalist group, the Sons of Freedom. As we would see much later in the century with groups like the Hare Krishnas, the Dukhobors were a new religion in this country, but an old religion in another. In Russia, the country of origin, the Dukhobors probably traced back to the mid-18th century, and by the late 19th century, they ran afoul of the Tsarist government by refusing to take an oath of allegiance, burning their guns, and refusing military service. The Dukhobors became a Canadian new religion when 4 boatloads of members arrived in 1899, and by the end of the year, 7,500 members settled in Saskatchewan. Within about 2 years, however, strains developed with the government, first over regulations requiring land to be registered to individuals and not groups, soon followed by requirements to register births, deaths, marriages, and divorces. These tensions, fueled by anti-materialist teachings of its leader, led to a march of over 1,000 devout and barefoot Dukhobors in October 1902. In the next year, 1903, radical Dukhobors for the first time marched nude as a sign that humanity was to live in a manner similar to Adam and Eve. They adopted the name Sons of Freedom, and some of them evolved into a terrorist organization that, at least prior to the Air India bombing, was unprecedented in Canadian history for the sheer amount of property damage and occasional deaths that they caused. As problems with land registry persisted in Saskatchewan, about 5,000 Dukhobors moved to British Columbia during the years 1908 to 1912. Those registration problems persisted, and problems about Dukhobor children attending public schools became acute with the government's introduction of militia rifle training. By late 1923, fundamentalist arsonists began torching schools in the Dukhobor areas of the province, a practice that soon escalated to include a wide variety of public and private targets: homes, lumber mills, community halls, power stations, electrical poles, bridges, oil storage facilities, flour mills, stores, and so on. By 1924, the Dukhobor leader and 8 other people died in a mysterious train explosion, almost certainly the result of a bomb. Over the years, at least one radical Sons of Freedom member blew himself up, and a few people died in bombed or torched buildings. One died on a hunger strike, and repeated accounts also exist of severe beatings having taken place within the Sons of Freedom community, as well as sexual sharing, and probably frequent sexual orgasms at the site of burning buildings. In the early 1950s, the government initiated a policy involving the placement of children in a dormitory called New Denver, which is located at the end of Lake Slocan. The physical assaults and emotional neglect that the children experienced in that facility became another form of exploitation against them, and a few years ago led to an investigation by the Ombudsman of British Columbia. All the while, however, the bombings and arson continued into the 1960s. I never have seen a total of bombing and arson incidents, but there were hundreds, with a loss of millions of dollars. While later in the century, Canadians came to suspect sectarian motives of a different ethnic group behind the bombing of the Air India flight, the violence by the radicals of the Sons of Freedom still remains unparalleled for its time span and material damage. Moreover, this extremist faction forever tainted an image of a diverse and usually peace-loving community, the Dukhobors, many of whose members lived in fear of their terrorist neighbors and relatives. While many people here remember the Sons of Freedom, far fewer people know of the group Alpha and Omega Order of Melchizedek. In 1969, former vacuum cleaner salesperson with a criminal record in the U.S. and Canada, David Livingston, moved to Creston, B.C. and began drawing recruits who were attracted to his odd mix of Buddhism, Christianity, astrology, Scientology, and so forth. An Alberta judge summarized the group's beliefs cogently when he said about its teachings, that its teaching stood for working with the never-ending principles of intelligence, energy, and substance. These three factors were intelligence related to the Father principle, as personified by David Livingston, the spiritual leader, substance related to a Mother principle, as personified by Karen Livingston, the wife, and the energy related to the sons and daughters within the cult itself. All these areas were based on the Trinity of creation. Followers sold flowers for Livingston and ran a vegetable booth at a local Creston festival. He also linked up with a local rock band, and which later went by the name Amethyst. At some point, Livingston and his followers moved to Vancouver, and by 1971, his 70 or so members were recruiting door-to-door, supposedly collecting money for a drug rehabilitation program, while Amethyst recruited young people through their gigs. A former member, however, claims that Livingston actually spent some of the money literally on himself and his wife, using it in part to buy a car and household furnishings. The rest of the money, some of which included members' unemployment checks, was being stockpiled to build a telepathic training center and a landing pad for extraterrestrial travelers. No doubt all this happened before the St. Paul landing pad actually got built, but that's another story. In any case, the group was registered in Victoria under the Societies Act and had a federal tax number, so the donations to the group were tax deductible. Public pressure, partly brought on by an article in the Vancouver Sun in 1972, pushed the group out of town, and they moved to Calgary. In Calgary, the flower selling and handicraft business boomed, and soon members were selling them in Denver, San Diego, Spokane, and Vancouver. Proceeds, however, still went back to the organization, so the members remained dirt poor. Livingston initiated a new form of punishment called the Honor Agreement, in which he banned members who offended him to other cities while their children stayed with him in Calgary. Members got sent as far away as Yellowknife, Charlottetown, and Fredericton. At one point, Livingston had five husbands living away from their wives in cities around the country, at which time he began a strictly spiritual arrangement called the Brides of Christ with those remaining wives. Oh, you know what's coming. In essence, he claimed a spiritual bond with the women whose husbands were elsewhere. Soon, however, he was demanding sex from all of them, wanting to develop a new bloodline with himself as the head. These children founders of what Livingston called the New Root Race represented a crude form of eugenics. Especially for children, life inside Alpha and Omega was hard and dangerous. They were at the eclectic whim of David Livingston. Adults, too, were endangered as members, and it became very clear after Livingston and his wife were convicted and sent to jail for having assaulted a pregnant member by severely beating her with a belt, I believe in Canmore. But Livingston's violent streak had been visible as far back as Vancouver when he allegedly threw a woman through a door. Routinely, Livingston or people acting as his agent severely battered men who crossed or upset him. And I do not know when he died, but in the early 1990s, his Edmonton followers still sold flowers through their business, Constellation Florists, table to table in the city's restaurant and bars. Violence, assault, and threats of various types occur frequently in new religions. Followers of Brother 12, for example, a very prominent New Age Aquarian leader of the 20s and 30s in B.C., his followers had been afraid to attempt escape for fear that they would be shot. David Livingston physically beat members. Yet another self-proclaimed enlightened master from Victoria, Robin Carlson, either beat members or had some of his acolytes do it. Carlson was handsome, literate, egomaniacal, and skillfully manipulative. Born in May 1944, he claimed to have achieved enlightenment within the Transcendental Meditation Organization on September 19, 1976. From interviewing former members in Alberta and BC, I know what excitement this claim caused within the Transcendental Meditation community. Enlightenment, after all, was the grand promise of Transcendental Meditation, but few, if any, actually attained it. A large portion of his followers, at one time numbering several hundred, came from that Transcendental Meditation background. Aside perhaps from gaining enlightenment, Carlson's most startling coup, and one that solidified his world importance in the eyes of his followers, came during the American embassy hostage crisis in Iran. Carlson received permission to travel to Iran so that he could witness and report upon events firsthand. Remarkably, he gained access to the actual student hostage holders on the American embassy grounds, plus conducted interviews with President Bodhisattva and Foreign Minister Sadeh Gupsadeh. The resulting book, entitled 17 Days in Iran, Revolution, Evolution, and Ignorance, cast Carlson in the spotlight, with reviews running in several Canadian newspapers, as well as in the San Antonio Express News in Texas. Part of his book was excerpted in the Tehran Times. No wonder, therefore, his acolytes thought that their alignment with him was the beginning of a movement that would have world-transforming implications. But at the same time that Carlson was writing commentaries about important political and social events of the day, he was growing hungrier for power and control over the very people who adored him. Early in his teaching, he claimed that people had to purge themselves of what he called the demonic. Later in his career, he actually accused particular people, not simply their souls, of being demons. Carlson's reputed attempts to purge them frequently took place in the context of roomfuls of followers, and he called them to microphones only to verbally tear them to pieces over whatever issues he chose. Occasionally, these confrontations led to violence, as when about 100 people witnessed Carlson kick someone in the face. Verbally, he was piercing and aggressive, and he coupled his verbal assaults with histrionic performances, shouting, swirling, kneeling, grimacing, falling to the floor, as he claimed to be wrestling the very demons that he was purging. As these verbal and occasionally physical assaults occurred, and I own video copies of some of the sessions, people often fell apart emotionally. Carlson knew their weak spots, and he hammered away at them mercilessly. In other exchanges, he intruded into people's family and sexual lives, counseling at least 5 women in his group to get abortions, rather than bringing children into a world that he had not yet purified. All the while, followers waited on him constantly and paid him large sums of money. Yeah, I think the mic... I heard the mic cut off. I'll speak louder. All the while, followers waited on him constantly and paid him large sums of money. Over time, some members paid tens of thousands of dollars through 15% tithes and various financial gifts. People put up with an extraordinary amount of abuse, but his followers left bitterly and the group fell apart only after Carlson led his followers into conversions into the Catholic Church. By these conversions, Carlson undermined his own charismatic authority, since he and his group now had to submit and follow the Church's teachings and authority structure. As members came to know ordinary Catholicism and its clergy, several people launched protests about Carlson's behaviors and instructions as they sought counseling and recovery. The Times columnist undertook a major investigation of Carlson, and its 5-part expose in June 1987 outlined the years of abuse that his followers suffered. The pent-up anger and frustration burst out from the rest of his followers, and as it did, Carlson lost his support base. A number of those former members, all in various degrees damaged by the time with him, moved to Alberta, and I've interviewed a number of them. Rumor had it a number of years ago that Carlson had left Victoria and the Vancouver area, moved to Toronto, and was substitute teaching in the Catholic school system. Carlson's group is typical of most new religions in at least one respect. They flourish for a few years and then decline and die. His group's beliefs were so discontinuous with religious ideas in the dominant culture that they had little widespread appeal. Likewise, his discouragement of couples having children prevented group members from parenting, which was the normal function for people who were the age of his followers. Moreover, the discouragement cut Carlson off from generating new followers by maintaining members to his second generation. Most new religions get threatened by secularization, but Carlson's group was threatened and eventually brought down by an established religious tradition. Another Western-based group, the Cavalarians, which was much better at survival, having now lasted for roughly 70 years, although the group's in considerable difficulty at this moment. In 1995, 450 Vancouverites formed a significant portion of the 1,500 Canadian members concentrated in Edmonton, Calgary, Saskatoon, and Powell River. It even claimed members in California and Holland. Now, however, the group's days appeared number, the result of some tragic incidents that provide glimpses into how leaders can abuse positions of trust. According to the Cavalarian website, the group began in 1930 with a discovery made by Alfred J. Parker, who died in 1964, of the connection between numbers, the symbols of language, and the focus of intelligence, which compromised the human mind. As Cavalarian philosophy evolved through Parker's writings, it had public teachings available through its books and public lectures, and esoteric or secret practices, private practices that only the elite experienced, witnessed, or participated in. Publicly, Parker wrote about the existence of a universal mind that Cavalarians could tap into and bring into their lives through the proper understanding of mathematics. Letters, including their combination into words, had numeric importance, and Cavalarians paid particular attention to their names, whose letters were assigned numbers, the sums of which indicated, if not determined, people's life qualities. After Parker died, the group's second leader, Ivan Shearing, more or less carried on the same theology and basic private rituals, although Shearing may have developed mediumistic and channeling practices more than did the founder. Parker had a status amongst his followers that was close to godlike. Shearing's status appeared to have been only somewhat less elevated. As one former member stated in 1995 concerning how he felt about Shearing, "I'd have taken a bullet for him. That's how loyal I was." Undoubtedly, it was a sentiment shared by others. Group members believed that both men were in touch with the universal mind and quite possibly even embodied it. Despite such veneration for both leaders that members had, only Parker is mentioned on the group's website. Shearing is nowhere to be found. The likely reason that Shearing's name does not appear on the website is because in November 1997 he was convicted of 12 sex-related charges, 2 counts of rape, 3 charges of sexual assault, 4 charges of indecent assault, and 3 of gross indecency. 11 women, all former members, had made the complaints that led to the charges, and the incidents took place over a 24-year period, from 1965 to 1989. Some of the incidents involved girls as young as 12 or 13, and for the offenses he received a 5-year sentence. Apparently, however, more women had complained to the police, at least 35, by 1995, making this investigation one of the biggest sex crimes investigations in the history of the Vancouver Police Department at the time. As one complainant testified, "He was my spiritual leader, so it was impossible for him to be sexual." One is reminded of another prominent religious case involving sexual assault against children, which led to a 2-count conviction of a teacher in a Hare Krishna school outside Vancouver in the late 1980s. While the Cavalarian movement certainly is declining, it's difficult to see how it can survive all the bad publicity and the critical accounts of former members. Another Western-based sect is expanding into a global phenomenon. Currently, people from countries such as the United Kingdom, Germany, the United States, and Australia, as well as some people apparently from Lethbridge, are flocking to Edmonton in order to be in the presence of the teacher John Zuriter, who bills himself as the living embodiment of truth. Born in Stettler in 1959 into a Dutch Reformed family, DeRuyter claimed to have had an experience of oneness with the source when he was 17 years old. As the experience dissipated, he embarked upon an intense spiritual quest to recover it. Amidst this quest, he met and married another Christian, Joyce, in 1982, and subsequently studied for a year at the Toronto Baptist Seminary and another year at the Prairie Bible Institute in Three Hills. Occasionally, he preached at Bethlehem Lutheran Church in Edmonton, and when he left the congregation, he took a few families with him. With these few families, DeRuyter led Bible study classes, and through its members, word spread about his reputedly special nature. Meanwhile, he met and then spent considerable time with a reflexologist and a metaphysical teacher. Through connections, he began holding meetings at a metaphysical bookstore in the trendy south side of Edmonton, eventually attracting well over 100 people to each of his meetings, usually four times a week. Through social connections, DeRuyter began holding occasional meetings in London, Hamburg, and Byron Bay, Australia. And in 1999, he visited Pune, India, and won over some converts from the Rajneesh Osho community. In large degree, the attraction of DeRuyter is not so much in what he says, but rather in what he does not say. His meetings go on for several hours, but has no scripture, no sacramental ceremony, and no prayers. In fact, much and often most of his meeting time with followers is spent in silence, with DeRuyter sitting in a chair on a raised platform, staring around the room and locking eyes with as many people as he can. These silences can go on for nearly an hour. Followers, however, can sign up for permission to ask DeRuyter a question by going up to the microphone, but DeRuyter sometimes does not even answer them. When he does, the content of his responses usually contain some general statements about people doing what they know to be true, but silence, rather than discourse, dominates his meetings. A graduate student of mine, Paul Joseph, figured out the power of the silence of DeRuyter's adherents. Sometimes the silence allows members to project their own insights onto him. In essence, people fill his silence with their own wisdom, but misattribute their insights as originating from him, or at least being embodied by his wise silence and sparse discourse. Others feel intimacy with DeRuyter through silence, since usually only good friends or intimates are sufficiently comfortable with each other to say nothing. Finally, in some instances, DeRuyter's silence seems punitive, literally a silent treatment to persons whose questions he chooses not to answer. His combination of silence, occasionally punctuated by slow, softly spoken responses to questions, seems captivating to hundreds of disciples, and his movement seems to be growing. Very recently, DeRuyter opened a new building in Edmonton dedicated solely to his teachings. Costing, I believe, well over $1 million, the first floor of the building primarily consists of a large auditorium with two giant screens, onto which a video camera projects the oversized image of DeRuyter through the meetings. In a recent meeting that several of my students attended, somewhere between 200 and 300 people probably were in the audience, with a wide range of ages his following. A considerable number of them are former hippies whose age of Aquarius never materialized. For them, DeRuyter probably represents the last chance to obtain those lofty spiritual goals that fueled so many of the 1960s and 1970s. But this quest for a perfect master and the society that he could create comes at a price. DeRuyter's organization, called Oasis Edmonton, is a for-profit company. It is not registered as a charity. Moreover, two of its upper-level managers are sisters of a wealthy Calgary family, and with whom DeRuyter apparently conducts a polyamorous relationship. Several years ago, allegedly DeRuyter received a revelation from God that he was to live polygamously, but God forgot also to give the revelation to his wife, Joyce, of some 19 years. After an acrimonious divorce, Joyce remarried and now lives overseas and has restrictions placed upon her by the financial settlement not to divulge the particulars of it. It appears that the living embodiment of truth wants to control any information that might diminish his status in the eyes of followers. Meanwhile, I and others in Edmonton occasionally get phone calls or emails from families and friends of Derrida followers looking for answers about why their loved ones have undergone such dramatic and, in their eyes, not healthy personality changes. I've heard accounts of large financial donations to the for-profit organization, internal group pressure for Canadians to marry foreigners, but no indications of anything illegal. Meanwhile, many of Edmonton's young professional and artistic set wind up in his meetings. At this time, it is impossible to predict how this phenomenon will end, and indeed, it may go on for decades. To conclude, please let me make a few quick observations. First, the amount of doctrinal diversity among new religions in this part of the world and elsewhere is extraordinary. It's astonishing. I continue to marvel at how creative we are as a species when it comes to generating ideas about humanity's highest purposes. Second, I continue to be impressed by the motives of members. At moments, we can even sympathize with the Sons of Freedom's reaction against materialism and militarism, even if we condemn their tactics. But as so many acolytes of these groups experience, they were all convinced, at least initially, that they were on humanity's highest path to salvation. Third, I am startled by the amount of abuse and violence that went on within many of these new religious communities. Similar accounts of abuse and violence are so widespread among new religions in general that they demand special examination, especially because the best indication of what will occur in the future is what has occurred in the past. Just from partial evidence from this part of the country alone, the past suggests that we will be in for some interesting religious times. Finally, I suggest that two religions that are active in Western Canada are embroiled in disputes that almost certainly will establish important legal precedents. One is the fundamentalist Mormon community, or should I say communities, in Bountiful near Creston, British Columbia. I've never been able to verify rumors that a small number of polygamists live here in the southern part of our province. I've heard these stories, I just can't verify them. Whether the government decides to enforce the criminal code and charge some of the adults with practicing polygamy, or refuses to do so because of the Charter of Rights, concerns over religious freedom, the issue will end up in the courts. As the head of one of the factions recently suggested on CBC's The Fifth Estate, the polygamists will argue that plural marriage, polygamy, almost certainly amongst what they claim are consenting adults, is not more problematic than adultery or swingers clubs, neither of which is illegal in this country. Critics may argue, however, that polygamy is inherently discriminatory against women, counter to United Nations conventions to which Canada is a signatory, often dependent upon government support through welfare and school funding and medical coverage and so on, and frequently involves arrangements between underage girls and especially older men. A charter fight over these issues is inevitable. The other case of potentially great importance involves a civil lawsuit filed in Calgary by Lawrence Hughes, who's the father of the late Bethany Hughes. The lawsuit alleges that the Jehovah's Witnesses organization is responsible for his daughter's death in 2002. She was a devout Jehovah's Witness herself, and she followed witness policy about refusing blood transfusion treatment for her leukemia, finally having to take transfusions under a court order. The father, however, alleges that the organization provided his daughter with inaccurate medical information and administered a form of arsenic to her under false claims that it was curative rather than merely palliative. The Cross Cancer Institute at my university is also a defendant in this case. the Jehovah's Witnesses vigorously defend all lawsuits against it, with its main lawyer for many high-profile and even international cases coming out of Toronto. The case will be a classic contest between religious beliefs, medical knowledge, and the obligations of the state and medical doctors to pursue recognized treatments despite the objection of minors. Enough of my comments, and now we'll have some from you. Thanks very much.